Okay, so let's pick back up on slide 13, microaggression and visibility. And I've already said quite a bit about this, or referred to invisibility quite a bit in this talk. But just a reminder that these microaggressions are reflecting unintentional bias, and it can be difficult for privileged groups to identify microaggressions as they occur. So remember that they're really privilege blinds, and we're going to be talking more about privilege. But those who are members of privileged groups tend to find it a little bit more difficult, unless or until they're trained to really pick out microaggressions, to really recognize them and their impact. And a lot of those individuals may consider microaggressions to be minor, or might encourage people to, you know, focus on the positive or don't be so negative. As therapists, we have to be really careful about attempts to help our clients cognitively restructure these experiences. So we're super used to helping people reframe and think of things in a more positive or a less negative way to help with, you know, depression symptoms, for example. But in this situation, I think we have to be really careful about minimizing their experiences with the world by encouraging them to reframe microaggressions as something that's benign, or the speaker didn't mean it, etc. And really be mindful of our own reactions to the stories that we're being told by our clients, and recognizing when maybe we don't fully believe the person, or maybe when we do believe them, but we're having difficulty really putting ourselves in their shoes. So the example I talked about earlier, a few years ago in a college counseling center, where I believed my friend, but I didn't really, really get it. I think that's a great example of that, where, yeah, you know, we might kind of superficially believe the person, but we're having difficulty really meeting them where they're at emotionally with these experiences. And practicing getting better at that, I think, is really important. The main point I want to make on this slide here, though, is this last point. And this is a hard place, I think, to get to. Again, when we're talking about people coming from privileged groups, and with an acknowledgement, of course, that our identities are complex and multifaceted, and most of us belong to some privileged groups and some marginalized groups. But I think, just speaking from the point of view of someone who is white, I know that for me personally, I tend to want others to make space for my own reactions and to give weight to my perspectives and my reactions. So if racism is coming up, for example, and I am maybe minimizing it or finding alternative ways to interpret it, or maybe I'm replying with anger or defensiveness, in my experiences with the world, those reactions of mine are important, and they need to be listened to, and that's kind of the place that I'm coming from. And thinking, really coming to an understanding that these are not the most important things to immediately address, can feel unnatural or a little bit bizarre, even maybe disrespectful to someone like me who holds white privilege, as the validation of my experiences with the world is exactly what I'm used to, and that is an example of privilege in action. But what's important here, I think, is to accept that the most accurate assessment of a microaggression is coming from those who are the recipients of it. So those who are disempowered, those who are coming from a marginalized group and who are experiencing them, rather than those who enjoy the privilege of position or power. So while I am used to my opinions being super important, and I'm used to my feelings being validated, when it comes to microaggressions and someone else's experience, it's time for me to take a back seat and listen and really believe those experiences. And although I might have some emotional reactions, or there could be that voice in the back of my head saying, well, you know, it probably had nothing to do with race, it probably didn't mean it, I need to realize that in that context, that may not be the most important opinion in the room. So I hope that makes sense. And I think an example of this is something that I came across in a blog recently, where a black woman was describing her experiences with talking about race in a room full of white people, and She said that at one point, one of the white women broke down crying and was very upset and felt tremendous guilt. Guilt for what she says was not her fault, that she didn't do, but others of her same race had done. And what this woman, this author, noted was that once that happened, it seemed to shut down the conversation, and the focus, instead of being on race and racism, the dialogue changed then. It was really ended, and it became about consoling this white woman who was upset and telling her it wasn't her fault and that it's okay, making sure she was okay, did she feel all right? And I think this is a great example of how when we're dealing with some of these dialogues and you have individuals who are coming from a privileged position, we can sometimes, even not intentionally maybe, but we can cater to that. I know that seems like maybe a strong word, but we can really take the position, sort of a default position, that their experiences or their reactions are what are most important or that we need to tend to. And by doing that, what happened, maybe inadvertently, was that the entire dialogue about race and accountability and what needs to be done about racism was shut down. So that sort of focus then on the white woman really is, again, just a display, or some would argue even a reassertion of dominance or that privileged position. So again, the takeaway point of this slide really is that we need to listen to others' voices and make space really for their voices and their experiences when we have a client coming to us and telling us that they've had a microaggressive experience. And why? Okay, so going to slide 14, why do we care about this? If this was something that just didn't cause any harm, then we wouldn't need a presentation on it. But turns out microaggressions are not minimally harmful. Sue, again, described them as death by a thousand cuts or nicks. In terms of what actual consequences are, you can go to the next slide. I think slide 14 is mostly kind of a summary of what we've already talked about. But to see the psychological impact, and this is kind of an accumulation of multiple different studies over the past few years, I just listed some of the psychological impacts. So anxiety, paranoia, depression, sleep difficulties, lack of confidence, worthlessness, intrusive cognitions, helplessness, loss of drive, stress, and an overall decreased sense of well-being. So, if you think about any other topic or situation that a client might come to us about that caused these kinds of things, these kinds of symptoms to occur, we take it very seriously. So this is just to say that we need to take microaggressions very seriously. Now, granted, with some of these studies, it's not clear to what extent it's, you know, causation versus correlation. But we do know that these are the psychological impacts that are correlated with ongoing microaggressive experiences. So this is something that we definitely do want to address in therapy, because we have good reason to think that it's going to actually cause our clients psychological damage. Okay, going to the next slide, 16. Just a quote here, which is, studies have shown that unlike blatant old-fashioned racism, contemporary subtle forms of prejudice and discrimination, or microaggressions, can impede cognitive function and performance. I included this quote here because I just thought it was noteworthy that there are some consequences that are present for microaggressions that aren't even present for the overt, you know, old-fashioned, but admittedly still current sometimes, blatant racism. And this is just to highlight that, again, microaggressions really matter. They have an impact on our clients, and they're something that we need to address. Okay, and going to slide 17, microaggressions and ethics. So tying this to our ethical code of psychologists and other mental health professions have different codes of ethics, but all of them have something pretty similar to what we as psychologists have in these three points. So first of all, principle A states that psychologists strive to benefit those with whom they work and they take care to do no harm. So first, do no harm. It's kind of a basic tenet of our ethical code. So applying this back to microaggressions, if we know that microaggressions are harmful, then in order to not do harm, we want to, or not to allow harm to be perpetuated, then we want to address this when a client comes to us talking about their experiences with microaggressions in the world. Secondly, and probably even more important, is that we want to take care ourselves not to commit any microaggressions, which is maybe impossible. I think that's a lofty goal, but we want to really make sure that we're doing our best not to commit any microaggressions, and just as importantly, that when we do, we can pick up on it, we can catch them as much as possible, that we can form relationships with our clients where they feel comfortable pointing them out to us, and that we repair the tariff when it happens so that we're minimizing the harm that we're doing. So that's Principle A. Also in our ethical code is Principle D, which is that psychologists exercise reasonable judgment and take precautions to ensure that their potential biases, the boundaries of their competence, and the limitations of their expertise do not lead or condone unjust practices. So think of microaggressions and the outcome of those as being unjust and unjust practices. So we want to make sure that our behavior is not leading to that. We want to make sure that to whatever extent we can control it, that we're not committing microaggressions, and again, that we're repairing them when we do that. This point about potential biases, just remember that microaggressions come about because of these latent and visible biases that we all walk around with. So, I mean, everybody might have different biases, but we all have biases of some kind, and that's part of being human. So we need to understand what those are. We need to be able to shape them, address them as much as we can. And then when they come up, we need to recognize them. So that's Principle D. And then also, if you look at Standard 2, competence and boundaries of competence, we see that it's important as psychologists that we understand factors associated with age, gender, gender identity, race, ethnicity, culture, national origin, religion, sexual orientation, disability, language and SES, that we understand these factors and how they can impact therapy, the services that we provide. And we have to make sure that we as psychologists have the training, experience, consultation, or supervision necessary just to make sure we're competent in these ways. So in that way, it's pretty clear from the ethical standards that it is our job to make sure that we think about these different diversity factors and how they impact therapy, and microaggressions is just one of many examples of that. Okay, moving to slide 18, microaggressions in and out of therapy. You'll see pictures here of a couple of people holding up signs, which are examples of microaggressions that they've experienced. So the Asian American woman holding up a sign that says, "No, where are you really from?" And then the one at the bottom, it's a little bit harder to decipher what that is, but it says, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Dear Dr. and Mrs. Rivera," and that is based, it's an example from an invitation he's saying. So what it was is that he is Mr. Rivera and his wife is Dr. But you see what the assumption is here is that doctors must be men, or usually men. So the assumption is that he is the doctor and his wife is the missus. So kind of an interesting one there. Actually, I know someone who very recently had this exact experience on an invitation. So I think it's fairly common. And then at the very bottom right, you'll see someone dressed as a Native American stating to a Native American, "But I'm honoring your culture." It says, "I'm honoring you, dude." So this is an example of cultural appropriation, but the person is claiming to actually be paying a compliment to the person. So this is not unlike a woman walking down the street and getting catcalled, complaining about it, and then being told, "Well, you should take it as a compliment." Okay, so slide 19. What can be done about microaggressions? I've come up with four not so simple steps. This is just what I've come up with. As I said at the beginning of the talk, I don't consider myself to be the foremost expert in identifying microaggressions because, again, microaggressions are in the eye of the beholder. And it's really up to the person experiencing them to say that something is perceived as a microaggression. So I can't be the know-it-all expert on that. And I don't think that there is just one way to address microaggressions, and I'm not the one person who can tell you how to do this. But looking at all the research and just all the work that's been done and the stories that have been told, everything that I've read, I've come up with four steps that I think can be helpful as we make a conscious, deliberate attempt at recognizing and addressing microaggressions. So the four steps are building competence. So this is in line with our ethical code, of course, which is that we need to establish expertise to the extent that we can and learn, really with an emphasis on continual learning, not learning once and then, you know, that's it, but lifelong learning. Two, knowing thyself. So this is about understanding who you are, your complex identity, aspects of your identity that are privileged, that are not so privileged, your own biases, and your own emotional reactions to yours and others' identity. So included in this is defensiveness, and this is going to be really key for addressing microaggressions. The third step is to see it, so to see the microaggressions as they occur. So Sue talks about how the main goal is to make the invisible visible, remembering that microaggressions are oftentimes invisible, and we want to make them visible and to know when a microaggression has occurred. And fourth is to address it. So acknowledge microaggressions, talk about them, and do your best to, quote, repair the tear. Now, breaking this down step by step, starting on slide 20, building competence. So this seems pretty straightforward, but I think it can be difficult to do because you have to remind yourself to continue doing it, because remember, this is really a lifelong process. But simply put, acquiring knowledge about diverse groups and clients, of course, that doesn't mean that that we should enter the world of stereotyping and think that we know everything that there is to know just because we've read the research on how to treat, for instance, Native American women. But acquiring knowledge is always a good thing. Do your best to provide culturally and population relevant services. Develop culturally relevant services through collaboration with different populations. This can be, I think, a really fun process. Sometimes we want to, as psychologists, sometimes we work alone and we're kind of isolated, especially those of us in private practice, and we can tend to kind of take on projects of our own and write things alone, and we can forget to consult or collaborate. But I found it useful to actually collaborate with the people that I'm working with to modify the interventions that maybe I learned in school, for example, to really fit that population. So an example of this is working with veterans. So I worked with veterans for so maybe 5 years, and I wanted to share with veterans mindfulness interventions for anxiety management, and this is something that I felt really passionate about. And I wanted to communicate these methods to them in a way that were digestible. And what I learned really quickly was that sometimes the way mindfulness is traditionally taught is not so digestible to veterans. So for instance, referring to transcendental meditation did not sit well with Vietnam veterans who had a negative association with that term back when they came back from Vietnam, and you know, thinking about Berkeley at that time and people who were perceived to be very liberal and calling them baby killers and doing transcendental meditation. So I found, kind of learned the hard way, that that was not well received. So what I did is I ended up changing the name of it, and the practice was changed a little bit to where it could be put into this mindfulness course. And that seemed to be helpful, even just renaming it. Another example is loving kindness meditation. I thought that was important to include in this manual that I was authoring. And what I found, probably not surprisingly, was that these combat veterans really didn't have an interest in sitting there and giving thanks for or sending loving kindness to, you know, the trees and the birds and the animals, and a lot of them were hunters anyway, so which doesn't mean that they didn't respect the animals, but they're not thinking of them really in that way of, you know, loving kindness. So what I ended up doing is modifying the practice so that it was called honor meditation instead, and what they did was that they would practice honoring themselves, those with whom they served, people that they liked, people that they didn't like, and it followed the same general format of the loving kindness script that I had learned, but it was replacing it with something that was a little bit more digestible and relevant to them. So that's an example of developing culturally relevant services, thinking of veterans as being their own culture, and I think they are. And fourth, learn ways to interact with and shape organizational structures, policies, practices, and regulations within institutions. This is commonly overlooked, I think. Sometimes I think we really just focus on the therapy room, the one-on-one interactions, and we forget that a lot of times we're in positions of power within agencies and organizations, and as part of our positions of power, we get to shape organizational policies and procedures. And that's something that I don't want us to lose track of, but to remember that as we move up in the ranks and we gain more power, we have the ability to address microaggressions at this larger institutional level. And I recommend doing that whenever possible. Okay, so going to the next slide, 21, building competence, next steps that you can take. And I have some resources listed here that you can go check out if you'd like. And I'm trying to do this with the slides throughout this presentation, providing citations and videos and references to books so that I'm hopefully helping to facilitate your learning and taking that to the next level. So in terms of acquiring knowledge about diverse groups and clients, I'd recommend checking out the book Culturally Alert Counseling, A Comprehensive Introduction by Garrett McCall. Another step for building competence is to view client as expert. And I realize a lot of us are working, maybe in inpatient units, we're really working more with patients than clients. And depending on when you went to grad school and kind of what that perspective was, a specific school or program that you went to and what they taught, you may or may not be trained to view the client as expert. So first of all, I want to say that I understand that not all clients are even clients. Some of them are patients. And this approach isn't going to work with everyone all the time. But I think in general, for high or moderately high functioning clients and even some lower functioning clients, it can be useful to take a feminist therapy approach. So thinking about what that means, and there's a book on this, Feminist Therapy by Laura S. Brown. But what I mean by this, taking this feminist therapy approach, and by the way, this can be used in conjunction with any other approach, CBT, DBT, whatever. But what this would really mean is viewing yourself as an expert on clinical psychology topics, on methods and techniques, maybe cognitive behavioral techniques or whatever you specialize in. So you're an expert, but to view the client also as an expert, and specifically viewing the client as an expert on themselves. And so this is where really trusting the client's experience with the world becomes important. And, you know, we're believing them and we're asking them questions about what's working, what's not working, and we're collaborating with them. So feminist therapy acknowledges that there's always a power differential in the therapy relationship. There's always going to be you, the therapist, in a higher position of power than the client. But in feminist therapy, we aim to reduce that power differential to whatever extent we can. And the way we do that is by collaborating, for example, when we're coming up with treatment plans. Viewing them as the expert on themselves, believing them when they tell us that something doesn't work, and being willing to change directions. So I just think that a feminist framework can be a good first step to learning about our clients, becoming more culturally competent, and beginning to address microaggressions. And third, developing culturally relevant services. A couple of ideas about this. Asking clients what work. One thing I did when I worked with veterans is I held focus groups. So I had them complete the mindfulness course on anxiety, and then we followed up a few months later, and they told me, this worked, this didn't work, I didn't like the language here, this, you know, basically learning what's digestible for them and what's not. So listening to them, and focus groups can be sort of a structured way to do that. And the second point here is consulting with diverse professionals, so not forgetting the community that you're in and other psychologists around you, and making an attempt to speak with other professionals who differ from you in some way. That's another way to just make sure that we continue learning. And finally, learning to shape organizational structures, policies, practices, and regulations within institutions. I put a website down here. This is the Ontario Human Rights Commission, and this is an appendix for a document they wrote called Workplace Policies, Practices, and Decision-Making Processes and Systemic Discrimination. And I think it's really cool because what they do is they list examples of policies and procedures that are either blatantly racist or just could be used in a discriminatory way. So maybe policies that look fairly benign on the surface, but that actually open the door to discrimination. Sometimes examples that they're giving are super kind of common sense, not having a formalized hiring process, and then they talk about what that leads to, which is that it leads to more informal hiring, which means maybe you just hire your buddy or people who are just like you, and that can exclude people of color or women or those with disabilities, that kind of thing. So that would be an obvious one, but they also talk about some that I thought were not so obvious. So reading about those types of examples can be a good idea because then it trains us to be able to spot policies that maybe we need to work to change instead of just kind of glazing over them and not realizing what might be wrong with them. So I recommend you check that out. And slide 22, know thyself. So this is the next step. And this, I think, is arguably the most important step. It's getting to know your own identity, acknowledging your biases, addressing shame and defensiveness, if those are two emotions that you happen to feel when microaggressions come up, especially microaggressions about a group that is marginalized but for which you are privileged. So for me, being white, if we're talking about racial microaggressions and experiences that people of color have, that might elicit in me feelings of guilt, feelings of shame. I might feel defensive, might want to say, well, you know, I didn't do that. I didn't own slaves. My family didn't own slaves. I've always been nice to people. I'm a good person. I didn't do it. That kind of thing. So part of getting to know ourselves is getting to know those reactions and learning to manage them. Always remembering, as a friend pointed out recently, that we're asking our clients to do this on a weekly basis. We're asking them to confront and address and process through emotions that are really, really difficult. And we need to be willing to do the same for ourselves. So if shame or defensiveness is coming up, to be open and willing to explore those and to make sure that those emotions are not blinding us further and getting in the way of us being good therapists. And finally, the last step in getting to know yourself is exploring the context of power in a therapeutic relationship. Kind of a giveaway here is that, for what I'll talk about in that slide, is that as a psychologist, you have power in that therapy relationship. So understanding what that means for therapy, how that impacts therapy, and making sure that you're using that to the best of your abilities and not doing harm with that. Okay, so going to slide 23. Getting to know yourself, next steps. So this is tough, again, but the most important step First of all, knowing what privilege status you have and how this can impact therapy. So first of all, what is privilege? It is unseen and unheard. It is invisible. It's described as an invisible package of unearned assets, which I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. Also described as a cultural tunnel vision, privilege perspective, and that limits, if not impairs, our ability as psychologists to provide ethically appropriate treatment services for non-similar vulnerable adults. Okay, so bottom line is that privilege blinds. So it is very, very difficult if you have privilege belonging to a certain group to recognize it, mostly because you've never had to think about that aspect of your identity. So I read about an example of a young white college young man who responded to a professor who was asking about race and racism and what he was thinking about that and how to address racism. And the man replied that he didn't really think racism was a problem. He didn't really see people as black or white or in terms of their race. And he's just never really thought that much about race. And the professor pointed out to him that that right there is privilege in action. The fact that you can go through your day, really go through your life without ever having to think much about your privilege. That is what privilege is like. It means that it's an aspect of your identity that you don't have to be constantly focused on or worried is going to negatively impact you in some ways. So for examples of privilege, you can look at the handouts, a couple of handouts on heterosexual privilege and white privilege, and reading about examples of privilege in action just in our everyday lives is the best way to really get to know your own privilege. I learned so much just reading about white privilege and heterosexual privilege that I didn't even realize before, such as, for instance, with heterosexual privilege, that that you can go to a movie, and I mentioned this earlier in the presentation, you can go to the movies and you can see heterosexual romantic relationships and a lot of examples of that. You can't find that really with same-sex relationships, and that is an example of privilege. You know, going through your world and your day, every day, seeing people who are just like you in pretty key ways makes it so that you can kind of forget that you're, you know, white or that you're male. It can make you forget that you're heterosexual if you're heterosexual. So know that privilege, knowing your own privilege is a difficult thing to do, but it's an extremely important process to go through. For a good article on this too, about why it's important to think about privilege, I included a link to Global Citizen at the bottom, and it's a paper by Kathleen Ebbett. She is a licensed clinical social worker, and it can be a helpful place to start if you're thinking about exploring your identity in more detail, but maybe you're unsure about why you should. The next step in knowing your own identity is to know what marginalized status you have and how this can impact therapy. So know that privileged status can impact therapy because, again, it's blinding. But also know the complexity of your own identity, and this is going to include marginalized status that you might have. So being a woman, I have marginalized status in that way, but being white, I have privileged status. By being a woman who was born a woman, I have relative privilege compared to someone who is a transgender woman. So as you can tell, it gets very nuanced and really complex, and we want to explore these different facets of our identity and understand how they're at work. And finally, three is to be aware of hidden identities as well in yourself and others. So not all disabilities are ones that you can see. You know, you might see someone parking in a handicapped spot and they get out and they walk and they look like they're walking just fine. We can't assume that there's not a hidden disability, that there's not some other medical condition that they have, or that maybe they know they can walk a certain distance but not a super far distance, for example. So we have to be careful about assuming that we understand people's identity when we look at them. Not all identities are obvious. And so with our clients, for example, we need to really get to know them and watch any assumptions that we're making about them. And going to slide 24, this is the respectful model by D'Andrea and Daniels. So kind of going back to the past slide about knowing what privileged status you have, the marginalized status you have, and different aspects of your identity, using this model is a great way to learn more about yourself. And what you do is you can go through each of that identity aspects here. So religion, ethnic background, sexual identity, all of them, and think about what your identity is and acknowledging complexities where they exist. So this model is actually created for therapists to better understand their own clients and the complexity of their own clients. So this is really a therapy tool, but I think it's useful to apply it to ourselves as well. So as we're applying it to our clients and thinking about kind of a case conceptualization of what's going on with them, considering all these factors, we should also probably consider these factors in ourselves and how it's going to impact therapy. And I included at the bottom there a link so that if you want to read more about the model, you can. Okay, and let's go ahead and take a break here. We're going to begin on slide 25 and the next part, so part 4 of the audio recording.